Hi, this is AE, and you're listening to a new series that we'll call AE Reads Skiffily. My intention behind this series is to share speculative fiction that I think might tap into the imagination of readers and artists everywhere. So this is our first episode. Today's date is November 3rd, 2016. So today I'm reading an excerpt from Dale Bailey's Teenagers from Outer Space. This story made its first appearance in Clark's World Magazine's August 2016 issue. You can find a link in my blog description. You can also find the story by searching for it in your search engine of choice. Since I'm not reading the whole story, a quick recap. An alien ghetto called Bugtown has popped up in a 1950s town in Ohio called Milledgeville. A high school girl named Joan has begun staying with her alien boyfriend, Tham, also known as Sam, but the aliens have a lisp, and they've been staying at Bugtown. And this is against the wishes of her father and her rapey ex-boyfriend, Johnny Fabriano. Before I read the main excerpt, I wanted to first read just a short excerpt that describes their appearance. This is from Nancy's perspective, because she's the narrator. Their appearance, on the other hand, there was no mystery about that. They were monstrous things to look at. Olive green, 7-foot giants, their squarish heads bifurcated by a big, ropey artery that clove their skulls into disproportionate lobes. It wound down between their lidless black eyes, shark black and as empty of expression, and split into frills of bony, close-knit flesh that almost looked like baleen. Their mouths, nestled between those frills, were the most disturbing feature of all. 3 slavering flaps of tissue that dilated open to reveal jagged, yellow teeth. All this set atop a massive torso armored in bone, with thick arms and legs and large, 3-taloned hands. This excerpt that I'm reading now begins when Johnny Fabriano, the ex-boyfriend, has convinced Nancy, the narrator, to retrieve Joan, her friend, from Bugtown. Now, as I read this excerpt, try to visualize Bugtown, and also try to visualize the aliens, like Tham. I went to Bugtown with good intentions. I went with love in my heart, and that was our undoing. Passing through the outskirts of Bugtown was like passing through any other dying neighborhood. Worse, maybe. A few human families lingered, but most of the houses stood untenanted, their paint peeling, weathered for sale signs jutting up from their unkempt lawns. But as we drove on, the signs dwindled and we began to see evidence of renovations in progress. Skeletal networks of scaffolding, stacks of lumber and cinder block in dusty lawns. Though still recognizably human, the houses troubled the eye. At first glance, you couldn't quite say why. At second, you realized that everything was subtly out of proportion. The lintels of the doors had been jacked up to accommodate 7-foot frames, the rise of each porch stair modified to reflect a lengthier alien stride. Even the angles were almost imperceptibly, disturbingly, out of true. The houses seemed to lean toward the street with an all but sentient vigilance. We began to see dusky yellow ground cover that you might have mistaken for knee-high weeds had each meaty stalk not sprung to alertness as we passed and turned watchfully to the street. Pale, violet shrubs choked out the familiar autumnal trees, their sinuous branches drifting like seaweed in the still air. Squat, plump cylinders of washed-out orange quickened with breath. Aliens began to appear, striding down sidewalks or rocking in the shade of front porches as the October evening set in. They turned their heads to watch as we crept by. With each passing block, the streets became increasingly unearthly. Entire homes had been buried under thick, undulating vines, succulent and smooth. They coiled around windows and doors and slithered out across the lawns to envelop street signs and lampposts. Fleshy, tentacled trees, I have no other word, shouldered up to the sidewalk and intertwined their limbs in a dense, rippling canopy that blocked out the sky. And in that swimming, underwater dim, everything pulsed with soft colors, pinks and pale yellows and blues, as if a single heartbeat throbbed in every living molecule. And everything smelled ripe and rich as gardenias just before they go to rot. And everything sang. I sometimes hear it still, that soft, arrhythmic music, ethereal and eerie as the tones of a theremin. It got under my skin somehow. It got inside my head like an itch I couldn't reach to scratch. There was something beautiful about it, and something peaceful, and something utterly cruel. If you listen to it too long, I thought, you might never want to hear anything else again. I wondered if this is what Joan meant when she told me that we could be free. Because it didn't sound like freedom to me. It sounded like the worst kind of bondage. It sounded like slavery. How come it didn't get you too? I asked. Johnny shook his head. I turned on the radio. I kept my eyes on the road. And Joan? Joan looked. I reached over and switched on the radio. Turned it up loud so I couldn't hear the music chiming in my head. How are we going to find her? I have no idea, he said. But in the end, it didn't matter. She found us. She was waiting on the porch of a house, or what had been a house, midway down the next street over. She stood tall and unafraid at the top step, the one unmoving point in that undulant landscape, her face softly illumined by the slow pulsing colors. Her hair hung loose around her shoulders, and those succulent vines twined around her calves like snakes tasting of the air. She looked serene, like a goddess or a saint, indifferent to mere human affairs. Yet she smiled when the Merc coasted to a stop at the curb. She smiled when she saw me, and the smile was her old smile, welcoming and warm and faintly mischievous. Just looking at it, I felt a surge of hope that she might yet be saved. Then Johnny silenced the radio. That strange, cruel music rang once again inside my head. Go get her, Nancy, he said. And when I didn't move, too mesmerized by the terrible beauty of Bugtown, he reached past me to the glove box and took out a revolver. I gasped. I'd never seen one. Not in real life, and I thought once again that he was nothing but a fraud, a child play-acting at something he could never be. But the next thing he did made me realize that it was infinitely worse than that. He shoved the muzzle of the gun into my ribs, hissing, "The fucking bug can't have her, not after what he did to my car." And I saw that Johnny Fabriano was crazy. Maybe he always had been, or maybe it was the mutilation of his car that drove him to it. The humiliation of the thing. The exposure of his cowardice. And the consequent fear, jealousy, and fury. Or maybe it was Bugtown itself. Maybe it affected different people in different ways. I don't know for sure. But when he dug the business end of that pistol into my ribs for the second time, I stepped out of the car and started up the walk. It was the single most terrifying moment of my life. The fleshy, yellow stalks of grass bent their attention upon me, and I saw that each one terminated in a black, unblinking eye. The snaky vines coiled around my ankles. I felt the gentle susurrance of the tentacled trees upon my face. The car door slammed as Johnny scooted out to follow me. When I looked back, he was maybe 5 feet behind me, pacing me, the pistol extended in one shaking hand. His face was strained pale, and his eyes were terrified. And as that alien music sang out inside my head, I felt the full peril of the moment bear down upon us all. Then, Joan started down the stairs. We met halfway down the walk, embraced, and stepped away. "How did you know we were coming?" I asked. "The music," she said. "Everything sings, and everything speaks. We all knew you were coming. Don't you feel it?" And I did. It was like she'd flipped a switch at the base of my brain. My nerve endings shot out the tips of my fingers all the way to the limits of Bugtown, where those first stalks of yellow grass sprang up from the October earth. A torrent of unfiltered imagery swept me under. I caught flashes of aliens nailing up studs in those half-renovated houses, of aliens sweeping off porches and taking dinner out of the oven and changing the oil in their cars, of aliens, of Eloise, bending to their homework and tossing frisbees in the dusk. Panic seized me. For a single flailing moment, I thought I would drown. And then, "Breathe, Nancy," Joan said. I got it. It was a matter of focusing the attention, of surfing the wave, and once I mastered it, I came crashing back into my own moment with a new 360-degree clarity. I saw Johnny at my back, brandishing his pistol, saw Joan smiling before me, saw Tham descending the porch steps behind her. He strode down the walk to stand at her shoulder. The central artery that clove his skull pulsed with color, pink and blue and yellow, each in turn.
"Hello, Nancy,"
he said. "Hi, Tham," I said. "I came to see if Joan wanted to come home."
"That's up to Joan."
Joan didn't even hesitate. "No, Nancy," she said. "This is my home now. I'm free here." And what I saw then was the most terrible thing of all. Joan had not been seduced by the aliens. She had chosen them. Chosen them. Bugtown might have been catching strange, but our teenage neighbors from outer space had not ensnared her. The era itself had induced her to seek another path. I understand that now. The 50s weren't an ideal time to be a woman. Has there ever been one? Factor in an abusive father and an oppressive religion, and lots of alternatives might seem preferable. She had made a choice when she'd taken Tham home and introduced him as her boyfriend. When she'd allowed him to walk her back to my house from school. When she'd kissed him goodbye there on my porch. She had chosen Bugtown, and given her particular set of circumstances, who wouldn't have? In striving to escape everything her father represented, she'd run straight into the teeth of a decade that was almost as bad. Wasn't Bugtown a better option? Wasn't Tham a better man? Who else would have left her to decide her own fate? Not even my father, and he was the most loving man I've ever known. He could see only one path for Joan in the end, and that was to return to her father's keeping. "Stay with me," Joan said.
"We would welcome you, Nancy,"
Tham said.
"Come with us. Everyone is welcome."
Then, looking at Johnny,
"Put aside your weapon. Join us."
"Never," Johnny said.
"Nancy?"
Oh, I was tempted. The world had little use for a plain girl like me, and even if she did make good grades, what future lay before me? A career as a nurse, or a teacher, or, God help me, a homemaker? A fate worse than death? But there was that music in my skull, that maddening itch that I could not scratch, that flood of images to be processed. Maybe I'd have gotten used to it in time. I don't know. But in that moment, I could not abide that sentient, serpentine world, endlessly interconnected. I was me. I was Nancy. And no one else, and didn't want to be. I would face whatever was to come alone, no matter the cost. I was free. "I can't, Joan," I said. She nodded. "I'll miss you," she said, reaching out to squeeze my hands. I never got a chance to reply. "You can't have her," Johnny screamed. I staggered away from her, tapping into that network one last time. I saw everything that followed with that same 360-degree clarity. Languorous and slow, I saw it all. Saw Johnny swing the gun toward Sam, his hand still shaking. Saw his finger white upon the trigger. Saw the hammer fall and the cylinder turn in its casing. I heard the concussion of the shot. Sam lifted his hand too late. Joan had already hurled herself in front of him. She took the bullet in the stomach. I saw that too, saw the force of it carry her backwards, saw the blood. There was so much blood. Sam caught her in one arm. In the same instant, the ropey artery that wound down between his eyes flared red, and a bolt of crimson light erupted from the outstretched talons of his other hand. Johnny never had a chance. A burst of flame engulfed him. The stench of charred flesh filled the air. His blasted bones tumbled to the ground. Then time kicked back into gear. Sam had already swung Joan up into his arms. He cradled her like a man carrying his bride across the threshold.
"Last chance, Nancy,"
he said. I shook my head and stumbled backward toward the car. Sam carried Joan up the porch stairs and through the door of the slithery, vine-grown house. I never saw either one of them again. I'll stop there. What I want from you listeners now is art. You could draw or paint something, or you could use your skills in photoshopping, or you could do a t-shirt, whatever it is. I would like to see it. I'd like to see Bugtown and Milledgeville and Tham in the eyes of others. Even if you think you're not that good, you might still surprise both of us. Post a link to your image in the comment section of my blog, or you can email it to me at ayusos1@gmail.com. Maybe I could set something up on Facebook. If I do that, you can post the image there too. This is the first episode, so I'm still figuring things out. Thank you for listening, and see you for episode 2.